Hello, and welcome to the Thinking Elixir podcast, where we cover the news of the community and learn from each other. My name is Mark Erickson.
I'm Cade Ward.
And I'm David Bernheisel.
Let's jump into the news. First up, OTP gains a JSON module. So it's official. We've talked about it before that the EEP for the Erlang enhancement proposal, we talked about that when it came out for adding the JSON module, and then the PR was open. And it's actually been merged in now, which is very cool. That means Erlang OTP is getting the JSON module and it's being added to the standard library. And being that it's in Erlang, it will be available to all the Beam languages. And the last we'd heard was the current working idea was to update the JSON package to actually use this underneath if it's available. So that would give a very smooth upgrade for us Elixir users. And just looking at it, we believe that this will probably end up in OTP 27. OTP 27 is currently in the RC phase. They've had RC1, but they aren't maintaining a separate branch for the 27 release. So this should end up being an OTP 27 RC2, which could even be out by the time you hear this.
Mm-mm-mm. All right. Also up, we got Elixir version 1.16.2, a bug release with some minor additions. There was one that stood out to me in the changelog that seemed somewhat important. It was a bug fix. It was about fixing a regression on how path.relative2 dealt with period as an input. So like, where am I now? What's my present working directory? That seems pretty important. I might have actually run into that at some point, right? If you're doing any kind of like scripting or anything dealing with files, you know, around where your script is. That was pretty important. But we also have some more tracing events going on when there's a def module. We've got some more mix additions like a mix.install project dir as in directory, environment variable for reusing mix.install installation. We got more. Some IEX things about discarding mermaid fence blocks, properly comparing pinned values when building diffs. That seems important too. So like, this seems like a good one to upgrade to. Don't sleep on this one. It is just a bug release, so no big deal, I guess. But if you're running into any of these, definitely upgrade.
And next up, there's a new case study article on the Elixir website. It is titled Scaling a Streaming Service to Hundreds of Thousands of Concurrent Viewers at Veeps. So checking it out, it's talking about Veeps as a streaming platform that was originally started off as a Ruby on Rails application, and it was working just fine when you're dealing with maybe 1,000 people on live streams. And then as they were trying to do these much larger events, hundreds of thousands, they knew they had to change to something else. They went with Elixir and they had a really great experience with it. I love seeing these types of case studies being shared with the community. It's a fun one to check out.
Yeah, some good buzzwords on there that they're leveraging, you know, Etz, Phoenix PubSub. They were using Google's Firebase. Now they're using Broadway. They're using Oben for background jobs. And of course, LiveView. They actually got some LiveView in there. If you're looking for any kind of reasonings to advance your mission of adopting those kinds of ecosystems and libraries, that would be a good case study. All right, next up, we got Kip Cole releasing a new version of his Unicode string library. Okay, now I didn't even know about this before I knew that there was an update to it. Here's the lowdown on what Unicode strings are about, and then we'll talk about what the update is. So Unicode strings support things like case folding, code mapping, like knowing when to upcase, when to downcase, Unicode segmentation to determine when to break or split or stream strings into graphing clusters, and then finally line breaking. Like, for example, if you're trying to organize your paragraph, what's that called? Justify casing?
Yeah, like full justification.
Yes, right. So they kind of like have variable spacing in between the words, but also oftentimes, I guess it doesn't matter on the kind of justification, but whenever the word needs to break in the middle of the word and go down to the next line, there's a way to do that smartly depending on your locale. You wouldn't do it at the first letter, big M dash, and then dive down to the next word, to the next line. You would do that in the middle of, like, I'm going to totally guess here, the next like syllable or something like that, right? The next root word kind of segment, right? It's all very smart. And apparently the Unicode group has data on this. And so that is what the Unicode string library is about. So if that sounds helpful to you, then hey, now you know about it. Okay, so now to the update. The update is version 1.4. And the big deal here is that it adds dictionary-based work for word breaking Chinese, Japanese, Thai, Lao, Burmese, and other languages. Those are definitely different kinds of scripting, you know, languages there. So the rules for them are definitely a little bit different, but now it supports it. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting there is this idea of word breaking. The rules for those aren't white spaced oriented, right? It's like if you just wanted to say how many words are in this document, you can't tell just by parsing on white space, which we would do like in an English or Latin based language. This actually takes the approach of using dictionary words to do lookups on these things, which the dictionaries are all stored in ETS. You only load in the dictionaries you want to use because they can be quite large just to load it all. And that means it's all into RAM.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. Like if you're in that space and you need to work with multiple languages at this deeper level, it seems like a really great resource. And next up, there was a new Livebook Helper project created by Jonathan Kwosko. So he added a project called Mix Install Watcher. And if you add this as a dependency to your Livebook notebook, then path dependencies are automatically recompiled whenever they change. You know, if you have dependencies and they change, it'll automatically recompile things. So this is really intended as a utility when prototyping alongside a mix project. Like if you're working in a Livebook, as you're developing your code and you start to pull that code out into a mix project, and now that mix project is a dependency of your Livebook, then as things change over there, it'll automatically recompile the Livebook. I wonder how popular it is for people to work this way. I've been seeing people talk about it a little bit more, like the idea of doing active development in Livebook and then starting to extract it out into a library. Is that something you've ever tried, David?
Yeah, I've actually done that with like the daytime parser and Phoenix SCO to an extent, just to make sure that darn things compile, you know. But also like trying to debug a library as well. I've actually used it a lot more for trying to debug library. I'll jump into my, you know, my depths folder and like start IO inspecting stuff. There I go again, IO inspecting stuff like an old person. I should be DBGing things. But every time that you do that, you make a change, you have to like, you know, mix compile that dependency for it to like take effect. This would be kind of helpful. I wonder if there is like a non-Livebook variant of that, but Livebook is definitely a good part of the workflow for just testing your libraries.
Yeah.
All right, next up, we got Herman Valesco shared a short video. This video detailed an example of an Elixir docs anti-pattern called complex extraction in clauses. I'm sure you've done this, and I'm sure you've come across this. You get to a function clause, and it's like 10 lines long. It's ripping all these things out. Essentially, you're not sure what is just being pulled out as just a variable or what's actually being pattern matched on it, right? Herman just kind of gives you an example of like what a bad example would be or bad practice would be, and then how to refactor that to be a better example. I can definitely see this. I've definitely done this, right? If it's a short little function, I'll use the function head for just extracting a variable or two, and there's no real like branching logic in there. But when there is that and a bunch of branching logic in there, it becomes really unclear what the branching logic really is because you've got a bunch of variables being pulled out at the same time. That's kind of the crux of the issue. So if that didn't make any sense to you, you're definitely going to want to see Herman's video because he illustrates the issue very well. So go check out his video.
And last up, Sparkline's SVG was released at version 0.4. So Sparkline SVG is a simple zero dependency Elixir library to generate SVG Sparkline charts. And I haven't tried this myself, but in our recent discussion with Dave Lucia about how he likes to add live view based admin dashboard support to his applications, I thought, a zero dependency, quick way to throw some graphs in to help visualize some data, something like that could be pretty cool.
Ooh, I'm going to have to adopt this one. I'm actually going to need this soon. I'm glad you brought it up.
I like SVGs. They're great. Woohoo. And that's it for the news. Elixir and Phoenix are incredible. They make it possible to quickly build highly resilient and reliable systems capable of operating at incredible scale. Fly.io is a great place to host Elixir apps. You can deploy your app to multiple regions around the world with a private network linking them all together so your app can cluster and globally do some incredible Phoenix magic. Give your users a more responsive UI while writing less code and moving the app closer to your users without needing an ops team. Check out fly.io for your next Elixir app. Today, we're being joined by our special guest, Zach Daniel. Zach, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Zach, we've had you on twice before, episode 27 and 123, both times talking about Ash, because you are the guy behind the Ash framework. And I think you have the opportunity to talk about Ash a lot, but we're bringing you on to talk about something else. Maybe that'll throw you off your game. You won't actually know what to say.
I often don't know what to say, but I'm excited to have my expertise tapped in a slightly different way this time.
So for you, dear listener, this is the last edition of our little mini series that we've been doing on operational Elixir, which is all of the stuff around the Elixir system, the things that support it for our businesses and our teams. I just want to mention that none of these things we're going to be talking about are paid endorsements. We're just interested in learning what works for different companies, where they are today, and what makes sense for them. Another way of explaining this is I've never worked at a company where we had like everything was perfect. It's like, oh, this is the best setup. There's always room for improvement. And I think that's okay. It's all about, you know, what is it that's meeting my needs today? And next month, we're going to have different needs, and that's okay. But we can all learn from what works at companies at different sizes, different scales, you know, different parts of their life cycle, you know, the early startup to the more mature mid-sized company or even larger. So I'm excited to talk about all that with you and what your experience has been and what solutions you're finding. But before we dive into that, I'd love to hear more about you. Like, where do you live and what kind of work are you doing?
I live in North Carolina now, which is actually a relatively new life change. We moved from Florida to North Carolina about 6 months ago, and we love it. We're kind of out in the sticks. We got some more space, got another dog, you know, all the we're country bumpkins now, and it's really great. I've been doing Elixir, pretty much exclusively Elixir, for like 7 or 8, 9, I don't know, a lot of years now. And I've worked at, you know, various startups here and there. I've worked at Dockyard for a while. My expertise has often been in like going from 0 to 1 and, you know, getting things off the ground, getting things functional, and then sort of especially that early stage growth, like, you know, 1, 2, 3 years of a project. I've been around for that so many different times, which is a lot of the inspiration for the other work that I do, which is like getting so tired of just redoing the same crap. And now I work for a company called Alembic. They're a agency. We do all sorts of things, you know, staff augmentation, project work. We're doing a lot of things with Ash, which, you know, is kind of why I'm there and why they're paying me to work on Ash. And that's kind of what my focus really is. We're basically supporting people that are using Ash. We're looking into some interesting strategies that might may or may not be announced at some point in the future. But, you know, it's all about basically how can we build out the Elixir ecosystem to create the sort of business that we want to support and to create that environment that we as a team want to work in. And Ash is kind of a big part of that goal for us, is basically like, we think that's a really healthy tool set to use for our projects and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, ultimately that's where my head's at, is basically how can we make Ash better for the Elixir ecosystem? And then on a business side, how can we find ways to support folks in the Elixir ecosystem?
It sounds like your experience kind of spans across startups, I want to say middle-aged companies.
Mid-size
companies. There we go. And enterprise companies, you know, larger companies, something like that. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. I've not worked anywhere with like 10 plus years of tech debt, really, especially if I've been doing Elixir for as long as I have. It's like nobody had 10 plus years of tech debt until very recently. The one thing I've seen so many times, and I kind of think of it like an ossification of applications, which is like, as you work on it, these things that seemed flexible and start to sort of become rigid and turn into more like these stone-like components that can't change and all that sort of thing. And that for me has like really shaped a lot of how I build things, is how do we prevent that from happening? Because it's just such a massive, it kills companies, right? And they don't even realize sometimes that that's what's killing them.
Yeah. And for folks that don't know that word, ossification, that's the process of forming bone. So that becomes rigid. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm excited to get your input on some of these things, because there is the different size companies, the different stages. Like, what I'm going to use at an early stage startup is definitely not going to be the same as what I'm going to be putting in a 15-year-old company that's grown quite a bit, or even older, right? Like a very mature thing. It's like, it's very different sized stuff for what's right. So let's jump in and start with the first one, which is monitoring solutions. Sometimes that's just getting error notifications that something happened and being able to track that. And it can also be, are my servers up? Are they down? Are they healthy? You know, just that kind of level of monitoring. Is there anything that you found helpful?
Absolutely. The first bigger open source project that I worked on was around that. It's a library called Spandex, which is for sending trace and other information to Datadog. Or my first big open source library, I say, for Elixir, which coincidentally is, like, from a download perspective, is one of the largest libraries in the Elixir ecosystem, which is pretty interesting. Like, it so wildly dwarfs everything, like the amount of downloads that any of my other packages have, that it's kind of comical.
Are you still involved with that?
It doesn't really need a lot, I guess, really, at the moment. And there's efforts to move away from that pattern actively happening in other places. Like, we're looking for, you know, OpenTelemetry to replace it. It's just that Datadog, OpenTelemetry, it's you know, Spandex is just a little bit easier because it's not this, like, generic. It was kind of built so that you could send stuff to Datadog. And so it's just, we found that a lot of people still use it because it's so easy. But in the long run, it's just not the direction we're trying to take things. OpenTelemetry is the, you know, the sort of thing we're trying to herald in that direction.
Right.
But it is quite interesting because I think, you know, we talk about, you know, one of the first things you mentioned there was the scrappy startup. What you need early days is very different from what you need later on in the picture. And I think monitoring is a perfect example of where that happens. So a lot of times when you're evaluating, like, what are you going to use for monitoring? It's like, I mean, how much time and money do you have? You know, you think of it like an investment, which is like, when you don't have product market fit, every dollar you put into a project is theoretically like dollars just straight up lost, right? The risk of those dollars is very different. When you have a product supporting thousands of customers, and, you know, all of a sudden those same dollars are safe investments because you are trying to grow something that has traction. And time is the same thing, developer time, right? Well, how many people does it take to deal with this and maintain this monitoring solution? And that's the thing. All tools, every single tool has a maintenance cost of its own. Like, there is no tool that's like, that's just, you turn it on and never think about it ever again, in my experience. So yeah, I think early days, right, my go-to is AppSignal for Elixir applications. I'm sure you guys have heard this a lot, you know, but it's the closest to a push button solution for monitoring Elixir applications. That's even supported by Fly.io recently, like, sort of integrating with them.
Fly's integrated with Sentry.
That's right. I honestly kind of would say they're both, to me, those products are very similar and fit very similar niches. I typically choose AppSignal just because I have experience with both of them, but I've looked at the ramps for both of them. They kind of go the same way, and you'd have to be more well-versed in both tools, I think, to get a comparison of, like, which one is better. And that's not me. But what's interesting is those tools, in my experience, have a cap. Like, they are so fast to get you up and running, and they're amazingly useful, which is why I would almost always start there. For a while, up until you get to when you really need a different level of observability and monitoring, and those tools, in my experience, don't really provide that, right? And Datadog is I think a perfect example of something that does. But the problem with Datadog is it's comically expensive sometimes, and it's so easy to accidentally, like, you know, they don't send you an email like, hey, you're racking up the charges, you might want to do something about this. Even if you have a plan with them, they don't send you an email that says, hey, you're going over our plan. It's like,
they'll just happily bill you, right?
Exactly. They have no problem with it. And I've actually, like, you know, working with clients of mine, like, we'll set something up and we'll realize, crap, we did not put an appropriate level of sampling, right? Which is the process of, like, only picking interesting or some small percentage of your data points, and boom, they're slapped with, like, some huge bill. And I don't think Datadog is even worth considering until you are confident that getting a bill 4 or 5 times how much you think you're going to get is, like, not a huge deal to you. And also that you're comfortable with the idea of it being a part-time job for somebody to maintain and manage that tool and curate your dashboards and do all this sort of other stuff. If you don't have that time and you don't have that money, then just don't even touch Datadog, right? It's just going to be such a time sink.
Does that mean that other solutions, similar solutions, Honeycomb, Lightstep, other, you know, metric-y kind of places are also out of the question? Or
I don't actually know. This is specifically to Datadog. I haven't used many things beyond that. You know, I've gone for, like, open source tooling, you know, Grafana, Prometheus, you know, mm-hmm. Zipkin is another open source tracing one. And those, in my experience, are you know, you're going to be protected from the cost expenditure at the expense of lots of manual setup. And so now you have like a tech person's full-time job, like a programmer's, you know, part-time or full-time job to manage these tools.
I guess it depends on that surprise bill you're getting. If it's a $10,000 surprise bill, then hey, like I don't, there's not a lot of developers out there that'll cost you more than $10,000, you know, for a month of setup. And that's a full month of setup. I don't even think it would take a full month, but I mean, it could.
I mean, if you're at the scale where you're going to get a $10,000 bill from Datadog, then like you've got some stuff going on. What I've seen is like, you know, you're going to think it's going to be $200, $300 a month. And then it's like $1,400, $1,500, which is still, especially for a startup or early stage company, that's insane, right? That's like, you know what I mean? Like they're barely affording $10 a month for some other service. Like,
yeah, if you're totally bootstrapping yourself and your significant other is going to say, "Whoa, what is this?" Then you're going to be like, "Oops," you know, that's something you feel.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think you know, to that end, that's where AppSignal, Sentry, it's just a no brainer that just go with those. And like the thing about Datadog I've always seen is it's one of those things where like you have this massive high fidelity stuff, and it usually doesn't matter. Until it does, and then you're like, wow, what a game changer this was for me. But it's like, are those moments really enough to justify, you know, $15,000 a year or something like that for, you know, and it's like, I don't know. It's hard to say.
I've seen AppSignal and Sentry and the likes be a little bit more forgiving when it comes to like spikes. You'll have a quota or you just won't get exceptions anymore after a certain point. There's a bit more protection on your wallet.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've done anything about it, but then maybe also I've been on the free accounts. So, but maybe things change when you're actually paying a lot of money. But I do know that, yeah, there's a quota. And so when you fall out of that, like you do get emails.
I think Datadog is so feature rich that, and they charge for like, they nickel and dime you for so many different things that it's so easy to just accidentally do something that costs so much money. Like one of the first times I was using it a long time ago, sending up all these data points, and we were like, you know, we want to tag these by like user ID and all these other things. And yeah, and like every dimension was like a multiplicative cost on each data point that you added, like, which in a small bit was fine, you know, like for, you know, it looked like a tiny amount, but we didn't even realize that we were basically like, you know, squaring our costs for metrics.
Classic noob move.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man.
I think that's a good point there is just, at that early stage, you're much more cost sensitive and you want to go with things that are much more predictable costs just to protect yourself. Because yeah, as you go through those learnings of, oh, we're being charged, the more data points that are being tracked that are unique or something like that, then you don't want to be put out of business because of accidental overages.
Devs want to treat these spans and metrics and stuff as like their logs, you know, and just putting as much info as you can up to the point that like the log gets truncated. but metrics and spans don't really work that way. That the high cardinality there is a billing facet, you know, that's what gets folks in trouble, I think.
There is a trick of sorts that I apply in those situations, which is like, and Spandex I think does this sort of automatically, but basically set your sampling rate to almost nothing, like 1%. Or even like 0.5%, but then all of your errors will go through, because that is when tracing is so useful, right? Is when something has gone wrong, and that it's so much more useful than like a stack trace or any other thing, especially when you have user performance monitoring, like on your front end that like stitches all this stuff together with headers and stuff like that. You can see like a user clicked on this button and then that button. And then it went, you know, that's kind of a little hack. It's like, you don't really need anything more than 1% of your successful traces to get an idea of how your application is performing. But your errors, you want as much detail as you can, right? Because that is really valuable, is like anything that addresses a production issue sooner is worth money.
Yeah, perfect. Until until you have something that's like recursively infinite, like calls to these error paths that are setting all these metrics.
You're referring to something I've seen, which is Oban jobs failing and then getting retried, and they have like infinite retry, and then it's just like, yeah, you're back off to the races of runaway cost for sure.
Yeah, we were talking about that before with supervisors restarting something that's crashing.
Yeah.
But you know, your Elixir app is fine. It's up and still serving customers, but you know, it's continually restarting things. Yeah, that can be a problem.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of mentioned a little bit there about the tracking user behavior, like a user clicked on this and they clicked on this. I would love to talk about user behavior, usage tracking, like getting insights into how your users are using the application. What is a good tool or pattern that you've used in the past?
That's a good question. And usually that's been something kind of out of my or somebody else's problem, I guess is the best way to phrase that. Like, especially when it's the sort of thing of like user behavior purely from a UI perspective, like what did they click on and when and where. There's this like event analysis tool or whatever you want to call it. There's a name for these types of things like post hog or like segment is another one that's like where you dispatch like every event that an application produces into this thing, and segment lets you like hook into all these things. And so I've built a lot of things that power those. And Elixir is actually a really good fit for this kind of thing, like an event bus of like every time X or Y is created and form is submitted and blah, 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 blah. And then you can like hook in third-party services to receive these events. And a lot of times that'll be like, okay, send it to Datadog whenever one of these happens so that we can have the metrics, and send it to Posthog so that our business intelligence folks can do whatever they do. Like, you know, so they can make charts and stuff and predict things. And what I would say is like, I haven't personally used most of those tools, but I've found that Elixir is a really reliable source for that kind of event data. And it's quite easy to build that into your application and keep it from like tanking your app. And so often I find it quite trivial to integrate with like whatever third-party data service somebody else wants to integrate with. Like if they want to receive an event stream from an app, it's like pretty straightforward. And the way that we build things, I think Ash comes into the picture here as well, which is that Ash gives you a single place where you can hook into everything that happens in your app that makes it really straightforward to say, like, you know, somebody's like, every time a user registers, I want an event that shows up in our business analytics platform or something. It's like, it's easy, right?
So do you have instrumentation hooks built in to support that kind of business event?
Yeah. So the way, you know, Ash resources themselves have actions, and actions kind of map to some, usually some domain relevant thing that is happening, like a user being created or a user being deactivated or whatever. And you can put in a notifier on a resource that says, like, basically a notifier, it does something, you know, at the end, after all the relevant transactions have been closed, the notifications that were generated all get called, passed into all of your notifiers that were relevant. And so that'll be things like user was deactivated, or, you know, it'll have like the resource and the action and all that sort of stuff. So that kind of design pattern makes it very easy to, if you want a fire hose, it's super trivial. Just drop the same notifier into all resources and send generic events like resource dot action dot, you know, whatever. Or if you want to be more specific and add some care, then it's just go modify some pattern matching to say, you know, pull out this action and this resource and then send those. And that pattern works, I think, quite well.
So maybe we can just touch on deployment. I know there's lots of different places where we can deploy our apps. What places have you tried? Like I've done self-hosted Kubernetes in AWS. It was EKS. I've done, you know, everything like from Docker files that I put up on my own machine, like an EC2 instance. Right now I do everything on fly.io. What are you doing, or what do you find helpful for your apps?
Currently, you know, fly.io is also my go-to. And I think, you know, you're going to hear that from a lot of people who are deploying Elixir applications, Phoenix applications. Although, while it is my go-to, it is not, and I, you know, I don't want to be that guy, but it's kind of far from a perfect solution. I've had a lot of, but you know, these are trade-offs. Everything in tech is trade-offs, and they're winning on other important axes, right? It's super quick to get started. It's very easy to manage and monitor, or I'd say to sort of manage my apps and things like that. But most importantly, it's just one of the few, kind of like GigElixir, which is a similar service I used for a long time. It knows about Elixir, right? Like they've made sure that certain things are easy, like clustering your applications if you scale up and all these different little bits and bobs. And compared to other places, when you want to build a cluster, it's flexible and relatively cost effective. Relatively. So, you know, my other experiences, I had a stint where I was using GigElixir. And realistically, GigElixir was always good. I never really had an issue with it. I think I started switching to Fly just because of the hotness factor that was happening for a while. And then now it's like, to me, it's like kind of like AppSignal Sentry. It's like they kind of do the same thing. It's like I have a Dockerfile based application. I want to deploy it. And I just go with whatever I used last time if it didn't really bite me too hard, you know, which I think is kind of interesting, you know, on its own. It's like, is that it's like a marketing game or something between those two solutions because I don't have a technical reason why I choose Fly, really.
It's just so hot right now.
Yeah, so hot. Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of it too is people make these choices based on almost like a perceived prospectus, like what, where are things going with said platform? And, you know, Fly made some smart choices there, at least in terms of the Elixir community by, you know, bringing on Chris and focusing on and really, you know, pumping up Phoenix, which is that it feels like the place that is going to have the brightest future. And for deployment, you don't ever want to deploy onto a dying platform, right? You always want to be on whatever has the longest anticipated support and what's going to get the newest, best updates and whatnot. So I think that's probably where they win that sort of marketing game, and how that happens is like, you know, they'll be partnering with Supabase and stuff like that. And that stuff is all signal, like, hey, we're making moves. We're still working. Like your stuff's going to, you're never going to have to, or you're not anytime soon going to have to go figure out some new way to deploy this thing. But I would also say, like, I kind of long for the days when I was just using gcloud Kubernetes, like GKE. I learned how to do it. It's not the easiest thing in the world, but once you know how to do it, it's fine. And it was much cheaper, actually, which is weird because I remember when people complained about how gcloud would gouge you, but it's like gcloud compared, you know, AWS is cheapest, right? Gcloud's a little bit less cheap, and fly.io is 100 times easier and, you know, 10 times more expensive than deploying your own cluster. And of course, cheapest is do it on your own computer, but I don't, you know, I haven't done that. I'm not going to buy the thing I need to do it. So
there's a nice meme on Reddit where people ship their best apps on localhost. They tell other people to go visit their localhost, mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, wow, this looks amazing.
Yeah, so good. So fast. That is funny. I do remember like the first time I learned, and this is early days things, but the first time I realized that like without your database being co-located with your app, you're like, it's comic. Like it's just so slow, so bad. Mm. And like that round trip latency is enough to make like the, you know, it's pretty interesting. Like in my experience, if your database is co-located with your app, you're probably fine. Like, you know, it doesn't really matter how many queries you make. I've seen apps that will like one GraphQL request will make 2,000 queries and they're like, yeah, it's a little slow. But if it wasn't co-located with its database, it's like you'd be waiting for 45 seconds or something.
Yeah, it's so funny. Just the way we write our applications, we write it with the assumption. We're not even consciously thinking about it, but we write it with the assumption that it's right next to the database. So that if I'm doing a sequence of queries, I'm going to pull up this and then, you know, using results from that, pull up some more data. Like that. And yeah, if you're dealing with higher latency, it's just, it kills it.
There was a big debate a while back. I feel like it's kind of maybe died down or just, you know, people don't care as much because they're using Fly or something like that, but about whether or not Elixir and Kubernetes, like they were like, oh, if you have Elixir, you don't need Kubernetes, or Kubernetes is just like a bad Erlang for other languages that don't have the safety that. And I think those takes are all pretty wrong. I think they play together quite nicely. And I think like we had a lot of success using Kubernetes clusters to manage Elixir applications. The thing is when you put Ruby on a, or something else, right, on a, in a clustered situation, all of a sudden you start bringing in like third party stuff. Like you start bringing in Redis and date and caches and memcache and like all this crap to like make it make sense to have a cluster of your applications. And it's like, instead of just having to rebuild the same cache three different places in each node and all that sort of stuff. But Elixir is quite nice about that, right? Like it's very, you can, the caching solutions that it has will like automatically communicate with a cluster, or you can use like Nebulex and stuff like that, where they'll consistently hash cache keys to all around your cluster and stuff like that. Like to just have that as a library you can install and not need to run a third party database or cache or something is nuts. I mean, it's just crazy. And so to me, it's like you get kind of the best of both worlds, because in Elixir, you treat all of your things like, you know, Kubernetes motto is like cattle, right? Your apps are cattle, not pets, right? It's like they can be killed and brought back up and you should treat them as such. Sorry for any, I guess, vegetarians out there. Maybe not a very good imagery, but Elixir is perfect for that because everything is a gen server, or everything is a process that is, yeah, aware that it can stop and will have to rebuild back up. And so things work really quite nicely with the way you've patterned your application to run inside of a process that it can be stopped and started. And, you know, mm-hmm. usually things are going to kind of be okay. So scaling up, scaling out, all that sort of stuff is pretty seamless in comparison. So I still think that that's kind of the holy grail for me. If I really am building something significant that a Kubernetes cluster somewhere, it doesn't have to be gcloud, that's the one I know, but you know, a Kubernetes cluster is on scalable hardware, like, is still what I would choose for like really serious projects.
I know it actually really was helpful at a previous company where I was, and because we had multiple services, like it was a service oriented architecture where you had some services that were like two of them still in Ruby on Rails and some of them in Elixir, integrating all of those different things and having some of the same types of ability to bring up and revert and just built into the platform. So it's not language specific, like this is how we manage and bring up a new instance of Ruby on Rails, but the Elixir one's different. You know, it's like, it was just all the same. So for those heterogeneous environments where you've got multiple different things, it is a really helpful abstraction layer for it.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of things that, and again, Kubernetes is really complicated when you get into it. And I think that's the thing that keeps people away from it, kind of rightly so. It's like, you should really know you need it before you bother using it. But there's certain things that you also like, I don't think you can realistically achieve with almost any other deployment platform, right? So a great example is, you know, auto-scaling on custom metrics. Typically, when you have auto-scaling clusters, they're going to auto-scale based on some hard metric like CPU usage or memory usage or something like that.
Yeah.
Luckily, especially for Elixir, CPU usage going high usually corresponds quite well to like your app slowing down. But in other languages, that's not the case, right? Like in other languages, and also in Elixir, it's not always linear, right? Like your requests could be slowing down without your CPU necessarily spiking, like especially if you have, you know, locks on resources or like these artificially enforced serialization constraints that like, you know, X, Y, and Z have to happen after each other. And then it's like, well, what do you auto scale on, right? Your CPU is not going up really, like, or it's not spiking to the max and your memory is not spiking to the max, but your app's slowing down. But with Kubernetes, you can auto scale on like latency, like how long it is taking for a request to happen, or like an internal queue size, like how long is my event bus? And you can scale out on that. And it's relatively easy to do, right? It's, again, it's not like Fly where it's just push a button and get the benefit. It takes some expertise, but that's a really powerful concept.
I guess one last thing I'd say about Kubernetes, and I think we should probably move off that topic because, you know, there's, we could keep going.
Yeah.
But one of the things that burned me is the Kubernetes platform kept changing and I have to continually update my YAML files and stay up on like having to go read the docs. Like, what is this new feature? What does this mean? That churn was a little bit heavy. And maybe that was just the time that I was in at as well. Maybe things have settled down, so it's not so much like that anymore. I don't know, but that got a little tiresome.
I know we said we were going to move on, but I'm going to offer you guys something. You take it or leave it here, but it's about Kubernetes. And it's a story I don't really tell very often. And it's about how I deleted a production database, a staging database, and all of the backups for both of them in one go. And it's a really embarrassing story.
Talk about productive.
Yeah, it was impressive. And we talked, my CTO at the time was like, I'm impressed that you managed to do that.
You choose Kubernetes, but also the double-edged knives that go with it.
Yeah, the double-edged knife there is called gcloud config connector, and I would just tell you, if you're thinking about using it, just DM me on Twitter and I'll tell you what you need to know, because I really screwed something up there that I did not realize was an issue.
Oh, funny. Wow. Well, it sounds like your CTO is quite understanding and not like, wow, I'm really impressed you did that, go find somewhere else to work.
Yeah, I don't understand why. It was really monumental level of ineptitude, honestly. Like it was like a regular straight up, I was in the wrong place when I ran a command like twice in a row, and like nerves made it worse. And like I remember thinking like, this wasn't really an understandable mistake, but I think it is an important thing. Like it's funny, as somebody who's made a mistake like that, that makes you understand why blame culture is such an important thing to avoid. And like to take a burden of these things as a team. And I always feel that way for everybody else. It's like, if there's one command you can do that did that, right? Like that's a sort of systemic failure to some degree. Now, of course, we were at a startup where it was just me and my CTO. So, a team failure is a me failure, but you know, whatever.
Just shout out to the Safecto Migrations talk in ElixirConf last year. It goes over that exact kind of cultural problem. In your case, it was just about Kubernetes. In my case, I was talking about database migrations gone wrong.
I appreciate you just sharing that that happened. You know, we don't have to go into all the details, but just that junior people, people coming in, you know, we can be super afraid that we're going to make mistakes. And what we just have to realize is if you've been doing this long enough, you have made mistakes. You have probably taken down production at some point. That brings a level of sensitivity to other people, right? Like you're saying, I'm not going to kill this other person for making a mistake because, hey, I make mistakes. And I think it's good for us all to acknowledge that, you know, we've been doing this for many years. We're not perfect. We're still human. We're fallible. We miss something under stress, under strain. We forget to do something. Yeah. So just have, you know, grace for each other.
Yeah. And by the way, this was like 2 years ago. Like this, I was a senior engineer when this happened. So like, this wasn't like they let the, you know, so yes, I completely agree. Like, and it happens and it will happen again. I'm sure I'll make another mistake that costs the business money or something like that. It's all about how you handle it.
All right. Well, I do want to continue on a little bit while we still got you. A couple other topics. In some of that, you mentioned like deployments and scaling and ways of doing that. I was also thinking about any BI tools that you may have had exposure to that maybe you're not using them directly, but you said, I've seen that this was really helpful for the company that I was with at this time. If you're aware of any of those.
There's a kind of two categories there that I've sort of seen, right? So there, well, I guess maybe three. There's things like Mode Analytics and Tableau. And these tools basically are sort of data analytics tools. Like you typically will point them at your databases, right? And it'll give, you know, your product or business intelligence teams or something access to data, like read-only access to your data. And then it has all these ingestion features of like bring stuff in from different places. And so that like the key feature is not having to ask a programmer to write a SQL query for you. And anything that a business can get away with on that front is huge. So that their business people can go figure out how to use this other tool instead of making it all run through the same engineering.
Yeah.
So I've seen those tools. Those tools are usually quite useful, very straightforward. If you know SQL, a lot of folks who aren't engineers know SQL. It's a very valuable skill. So that's kind of the first category. Those are usually pretty easy to set up too. Like just need read-only production credentials and you're good to go.
Yep.
The other one is like, and I think I'd be willing to bet both of those things I just listed probably do this. I just haven't done it with them is like event metrics and things like that, right? So like product events, which aren't necessarily codified in the data that you have in your database, right? It's this other type of data. So like a good example is like a user visits the pricing page or, you know, a user signs up. You can't necessarily say that like every user in your database like was a user registering, right? Like that's not quite the same thing. Like maybe you did a bulk import or it's not quite the same to look at just the data versus this event stream of what happened. And I found that to be a really powerful pattern. I talked about a little bit about this is like, you know, build in like a bus that takes some standard format of events from your application. You don't need to use Ash, whatever you want, just have a system that is handling all of these events and make sure that your event format is like consistent, however you figure it out. Like some make some struct that defines like, okay, the key is this and the resource is this or this ecto schema, whatever it is you want to do. And then make it so that you can hook in little handlers, you know. So then if you want to send it to Mode or if you want it like Posthog is one that I know a client of mine uses and they're pretty happy with it. And so if you want to send out those events, you can then hook in. That alone will start to give you sort of superpowers to hook into other systems and get analytics. Mm. But then there's another category, which is, I think, found quite interesting. It's almost like an if this, then that type no code tool. And that's a segment I brought up earlier is that kind of thing that I've found to be even, you know, especially interesting, especially when you have technical or semi-technical, you know, non-engineering folks. One of the startups that I worked at was it's called Variance. Great, great founders, great team. Were cool with me when I deleted their databases. I had a lot of respect for them. And they did one of the things that they did that I thought was super interesting is they did a really good job of that pattern of reducing strain on engineering by bringing in Segment, where our job was just to make sure that simultaneously that all of these events were sent over to Segment, and that also there was this massive event log of everything we wrote to Google BigQuery. And so what they were able to do, like if they wanted to, for instance, our initial beta thing was like, you could submit, you know, put your email in and submit a type form or whatever it was. And you might get an email from our founder to get you like an onboarded to try it out. Right. And that was all handled with like, they did like on their own thing, you know, and they were able to use
segment to sort of drive all of that, where we would, you know, they'd get a little pop-up and segment an event that's like user signed up and they were able to hook up their own automations, like send an email and do all these different things.
Oh, nice.
That's super powerful. It's not like a free thing. You have to have somebody who's smart, you know, smart enough or, you know, technical enough to manage that stuff. But you can really unlock your engineering team's velocity by offloading these things that are kind of like low. They're just not the meaty stuff that you really want your people focusing on. So that's a pretty cool pattern.
That is pretty neat. I come across that pattern, and I think using it in like these reporting or analyzing kind of contexts is like supremely powerful, like you're mentioning. I've also seen it as like core business logic though too, where it feels like they're, you know, I don't know. I have this like love-hate relationship with like event-based architecture where they just kind of like emit these events and you got these handlers on the other side of the code base just like receiving them and processing them. And the primary trade-off there that I've seen for DevX at least is that you can't trace this anymore. Like you can't like follow the stack trace anymore. Like where did this come from?
Yes.
It reminds me of like old Rails JavaScript templates with jQuery. And like this is just like this old school like telephone operator switchboard kind of like wires crossing everywhere. They're just like just connecting all these odd things together, and there's no like good way to like trace one of them.
I think of it kind of like the way old school go to.
Yes.
When you're in the code and it's just, how did I get here? I don't know. I think that happens a lot with microservices. So I understand the whole desire for event-driven thing.
I do love the idea of this being constrained to like an analyze or reporting kind of thing. Like that sounds like right where you need it.
Yeah, but not driving business events that continue your code necessarily, but like for reporting.
Like
yeah.
To make things work at all, you know?
It's definitely an art of using these things for things that are actually sort of at the edge. Like that good example of like, we didn't have a sign-in flow. And so one of our leadership teams set up a thing where it'll email you and then he can go in and create a user for you. And it's like, that was a good way to save engineering time on building like sign-up flow when we were still working on like super core logic. But yeah, that's like, it has to be these either temporary and or preferably something that really lives on the edge and isn't core logic. But I don't have a love-hate. I just have a regular dislike relationship with event-oriented systems. Like, and it's, I think it's funny because Elixir pattern matching actually like makes it harder even sometimes to find, like people are like, it's so easy, especially I think when you haven't seen this go wrong, have the experience of like, look how easy it is to add something. Like, look how easy I can just add a handler into my event stream or whatever. And like, wow, look at that. I didn't have to change anything else, right? But then they're not thinking, or at least in my opinion, it's more important that like adding things is a lot easier than finding out what it is, like what is happening and why. And if I have to go to some def handle with a pattern match, you know, or handle event or receive whatever with it, and I have to visit all 30 of your gen servers or something like that, or like to find out like which ones will handle this request that I'm about to make, like that's a failure. That's a massive failure.
There's a table flipped at your house, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we close, I do want to also talk about a couple more things. One is right now we're talking about events and triggering messages that go outside the system. And that's a good lead in for emailing solutions. And is there any particular provider or setup? It's like your go-tos to start with for emailing with Elixir systems.
There is, and I'm trying to remember what it's called because I set it up and it's a great thing. I set it up once, they charge me $10 a month and they send my emails and I don't have any that's the thing. I don't have any massive volume stuff going through this, but it's like a postmark. Yeah, postmark.
Everyone's raving about postmark. I've not used it.
Me either. I'm going to have to try now. It's multiple people have recommended that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I think I first encountered Postmark like back in the Heroku days, like when I was building Ruby on Rails apps, and they were like just built into Heroku. So I never really had to think about it. They were like push a button, they'll tack on Postmark bill to your Heroku bill. And so I just, when I was looking for emails, you know, I was like, what am I going to use? And I send, you know, my stuff sending maybe a couple hundred emails a month or something like this through this platform, but it's cheap, easy to set up, works. That's really, for me, that's all I need.
Is there anything that you've learned along the way that you would share with an Elixir professional coming up behind you? Like they're just a couple steps behind you in the process and like something that you've either learned recently or that you've like, wow, I keep coming back to this thing as being important. Is there anything like that that you would share?
Maybe a couple things, but I'll keep them short. The first one is async is not the answer that you think it is. You don't just make everything faster by putting it with, you know, async. So you really want to understand the implications of doing that. A really simple example is if you like task.async to run two queries side by side, if you're getting a lot of data back, you got to copy all the memory from the one task into the task that you called it from. And like in a lot of times, that's just not worth it. And so, yeah, it's extremely powerful that we have the concurrency guarantees that we have in Elixir, but it's not a silver bullet. And I think that was something that took me a while to learn early on. It's like, oh, just task async stream or whatever. And now it's 8 times faster and it's not really true. And the other one I would say is it's the same kind of something that I am pushing specifically with Ash as well, but declarative programming has been such a lifesaver for me to the point that I like, you know, to some degree sort of championing it. But this idea, whether or not you use Ash, it doesn't really matter to me, but the idea of sort of separating out the what from the how in your application, which often looks like some data structure that defines how something's meant to work, followed by with another piece that's designed to interpret said data structure and do the job that you said it, you know, that you told it to do, is so powerful, especially for systems that change significantly over time that you need to communicate with business stakeholders with, and that has like a high axis of change where like all the different, you know, you have like 20 different things and, you know, properties of many of them might change over time. Like after, it's a bad explanation of it, but I think ultimately look into declarative design, declarative programming, and find some ways to apply it in your own code base, because it can be a really game changer for how you build things.
Thanks for sharing those. Well, Zach, I really appreciated you taking the time to talk with us and share some of the things you've learned along the way and the services that you find helpful, beneficial, and what works at different scales. It's funny because Kubernetes hasn't come up before, but you know that is a real answer for some people. And that for the right situation, the right problem, that might be the best solution. So I'm just glad you mentioned that one. But if people want to get in touch with you or follow you online, where should they go to do that?
We're on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, Zach S. Daniel 1, worst Twitter handle ever. We have Ash Framework on Twitter. We have Discord. Check us out on GitHub and everything. Ash 3.0 is coming out soon. Probably this month, we have a release candidate for Ash, and every other package will also have to have a release candidate because it is a breaking change, which is a pain, but it is what it is. But we're really excited about it. So I'm excited for people to get their hands on it. That's us.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us next time on Thinking Elixir.